young animals play.
Yeah.
They do. And even some of my one-year-olds, if, you know, if they're rushing down the hill, some of them start leaping in the air. There's no reason for that other than the joy of leaping in the air.
May we all live life with the joy of a lamb just leaping in the air for no other reason than to just do it. Hello, Makers. My name is Jen, and I am head of marketing for Making, and this is Making Conversation, a podcast where we celebrate all things making, the app and the act. I am so excited for our guest today. I had seen the book that they wrote flowing around my social media and popping up every once in a while, and every single time I saw it, I was like, okay, I need to remember to read that book. And it seems so interesting. And so when we were connected, I was absolutely delighted. So welcome, Jane Cooper, author of The Lost Flock, Rare Wool, Wild Isles, and One Woman's Journey to Save Scotland's Original Sheep. Thank you so much for joining us. So my first question to you is, how does it feel to be a hero to a whole entire breed of sheep?
Pretty scary. it's a team effort. It is so much a team effort. I mean, yes, it's my name on the book, but as you'll know from reading the book, so many people are part of the story, connected to these very special little sheep. Yeah. So that's how I cope with it.
Fair. The pressure isn't all on you, though. You've played a very big and important part. Before we get into all of your journey through this and talking about the book, I want to start talking about you. And I want to know, what is your maker journey?
My maker journey is age 5 with the scarf, knitting the scarf. And when my mum died, I found she'd actually kept my first scarf. So it's now actually down with my daughter in her box of family heirlooms. So, yes, it was. I mean, this was 1963. All girls were taught to knit. I'm one of 4 children. And the way mum could tell us, identify us all if we were out in a really busy place, she knitted us all sweaters in the same colour. And she'd say, okay, today you're to wear the red sweater. And then she could just look for 4 kids wearing the red sweater. I'm the eldest, and I got to 13, and I thought, So I knitted myself a sweater. I took my knitting up to the next level, and I knitted myself a sweater in a gorgeous raspberry pink colour, and then not really stopped since then.
So who taught you how to knit?
It was my mum.
Your mom, yeah.
It was my mom.
Were there other crafts that were introduced around that same time, or was the focus mostly knitting?
There was crochet around, of course, but I'm left-handed, and I'm the only person in my family who's left-handed, apart from one male cousin. So no one taught me how to crochet.
Oh, well,
because knitting's a two-handed job. And so to this day, I did go on a course for left-handed crocheters, and actually I'm not very good at it.
We all have our strengths. It's good to know what they are.
And then spinning followed, and then weaving followed. And now I want to learn narl binding. And my wonderful husband has made me a replica Viking warp weighted loom, which I still need to sort of do the thread setting up bit and the heddles and get onto the internet and find out how to do it. But yes, so that's the next thing. Never run out of things to do with wool.
Do you have any memorable experiences growing up with craft or wool?
Just carrying on knitting, making up my own patterns. The sweater that was too short and about probably 3 of us could have squeezed into it. First time I knitted with alpaca. And of course, as you know, it's not like wool, and it ended up down by my knees. So I've had probably similar adventures. The first one thing I did do when I first learned to spin was I got myself 100 grams of lovely dyed Shetland wool, and I decided I'd try and spin some yarn and knit myself a hat in a weekend. I mean, spinning, I couldn't get my head around how long it would take me to spin something usable. And I still do that in still do have that hat. Actually, I wore it this morning on my route march up the hill. I need to get fitter at this time of year because in a few weeks I'll be chasing lambs.
Oh, yes.
So, and with the weather in Orkney, you kind of can stay in the house a bit more than usual, apart from going out to tend to the animals on the farm. So, yeah, route marching up the hill. And it's pretty cold here, so
yeah,
I've still got that little hat.
Nice. I live in Seattle, so right now I'm like looking outside and it's sad and wet. And
yeah,
I understand the I would rather be inside at this time of year.
Yeah. It's the wind chill here. It gets to 50 miles an hour, the winds. Ooh. And the locals say, bit of a breeze.
Yeah.
And then 70 miles an hour isn't uncommon. And anything like livestock trailers or caravans, they actually have to be strapped down for the winter. Otherwise, they blow over. And there's always someone who moves to Orkney with a family and they put up one of these trampoline things in the garden. Mm-hmm. And then it ends up miles away.
All right. Well, note, if you ever move to Orkney, do not bring a trampoline. Okay. So let's talk about the sheep. So you go into many details and facts about why these sheep are so special. And obviously, we highly recommend reading the book because there's just so much information that's so fascinating in there. But if you were to give like a short version yeah. of why these sheep are so special as somebody who has gone through this journey, what would you say?
They're ancient. They haven't changed much since they came into Britain with the first Neolithic farmers 6,000 years ago. They've got very close cousins of sheep that are native to Orkney called the North Twanlsay sheep. Some people have heard about them. They're the sheep that live on this little island in the north of Orkney and they eat seaweed and they live on the shore. And they've they found Neolithic remains in Orkney. And they've looked at the skulls and the bones of the sheep and compared them to modern North Twanlsay, and they're almost identical. And Borroway and North Twanlsay come from this same root, and they are very, very similar in so many ways. They've been on St Kilda, on an uninhabited island, for centuries. So they were pretty feral. They still are on this little island, but they bought some off in the 1970s for research. And that's how they came to be in the rest of the UK. Mine are very special because we discovered in 2017, the Rare Breed Survival Trust came up and examined them and the records, that they are actually a separate line to all the other Borroway sheep outside St Kilda. And all that exists of that line of known provenance is within Orkney, are in flocks kept by other Orkney Borroway farmers. We form a very loose collective. We call ourselves a community and we work together very closely. And there are 8 of us with the sheep so far. And then various craftspeople and butchers and a weaver and all sorts of people who are part of our community.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. How many sheep are roughly are within that community?
At the moment, we're well over 200 between
us. Oh, my goodness. That's a party.
Yeah, I mean, when I started, I got the last remnants of what was known as the lost flock, and it was 4 rams and 11 ewes. So over 10 years, that's been a huge increase in numbers.
I know. I loved hearing about, again, trying not to give too much away because everybody just needs to go read the book or actually listen to it too, because that's listened to it. It's partly because my ADHD, it's hard to sit down and physically read a book, but also so that I could like make notes and knit and do all the things at the same time. Listening to it was so lovely because your voice is so soothing. And even my partner heard the book and he was like, is that who's going to be on the podcast? I was like, yeah. And he was like, that voice is just so soothing.
Oh my goodness. I must pass it on to my children. Do they think I have a soothing? I don't know.
Fair. But highly recommend listening to it if that is your style.
I was thrilled when the publishers when Chelsea Green decided to go with the audiobook because so many people I know listen while they craft.
Yeah. So, of course, this podcast, being what it is, celebrating all things making, If we are going to talk about the sheep, we should talk about the fiber that mm-hmm. they produce.
I think in America, people are much more familiar with Icelandic fleece, which mm-hmm. is the same double-coated. So it has a very strong outer coat and then a very fine undercoat.
Oh, right.
And historically, what was done was that the two were separated. And I can actually demonstrate this, I think. Yes. There we go. So that's the hair. And that is separated a bit more. And that is the lovely soft undercoat. And I have here, I really wish we could have like feely video.
I know.
Because this is some of the very softest, most luscious, gorgeous undercoat. And it just is so gorgeous.
Yeah.
The fact that you've actually got two fibers in one is historically was so important. They were separated, and Viking sails on their long ships as they dashed around the North Atlantic, they were made of wool.
Yes.
And for all the people,
I read that and I was like, this is mind-blowing.
It is because the technology is so, it's just so sophisticated.
Yeah.
So these very long, strong, hairy fibers that I've got here, they formed the warp on their warp-weighted looms.
Oh.
So that's the bit hanging under tension. Mm-hmm. And then the weft, which for non-weavers is the bit you weave in and out,
mm-hmm.
that was the undercoat. And they spun the two of them in different directions, because I have actually here, and this is thanks to a wonderful American friend, Sarah Jane. She bought me, I don't know if you can see it, this is a replica Viking spindle. So wow. I can actually show people how to spin the yarn. They spun it in two different directions, and then it was usually a 2x2 twill, and they wove it in strips, which were then fulled by being put into the ocean, weighted down with rocks, and that did all the fulling. So fulling, the wool shrinks a bit as if you were making mm-hmm. felt, and that closes up the cloth and makes it tighter and stronger. Then they sewed the strips together, and then they put various oils and gunks on the sail to make it even more waterproof. And they have done replica sails like this and discovered that they are incredibly efficient. They form a three-dimensional shape in the wind, and they can absorb wind gusts far stronger than hemp or linen or any other sails.
Wow.
Interestingly, let's shout out for women, because it was woman's work.
Mm-hmm.
Two men could build a small Viking boat in 2 weeks. Two women would take 2 years to prepare the wool, spin it, weave it, make the sail. 2 years. So very special.
I know. That's amazing. And I wrote down each sail, it was the wool of, was it 2,000 sheep?
Yeah, the big ones, yes.
Ooh.
Yeah. And they worked out, because of course they wore a lot of wool clothes, because of this remarkable property of wool that it absorbs a lot of water. You don't feel wet when you're wearing it. The chemical reaction generates a bit of heat, so you keep warm when it's wet. I mean, mm-hmm. you think of the Vikings in these open boats, as well as, you know, the women wandering around in Norway and Iceland, and it's wet.
Yeah.
So you need clothing that's going to keep you warm and dry. And they worked out to provide all the clothing and bedding and the sails and everything. The Vikings needed 2 million sheep at their height, which is why they had them scattered on little islands around the North Atlantic.
Again, there's a lot of interesting facts, but that one took the cake for me. I was like, oh my goodness. I mean, you know, we're sitting here doing our fun little projects. That's what it feels like compared to something like that. It's like, I made a cropped top and here it is. And they're like, we're making giant sails for it.
But it's skills. The skills are the same. All of us alive today have ancestors who were women who did this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an unbroken chain of wool working.
Yeah. I like to look at it like that. I like that you look at it like that. That's beautiful. We're keeping it going.
Oh, yes. In our own way, you know, and moving forwards with it. And they're now using wool to make so many very high-tech fibers. I mean, a lot of the Olympic athletes, there is wool in their very specialized sportswear.
Oh, I didn't
the astronauts
know that.
Wear wool. Wow. I mean, wool has the property that it deodorizes. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to wash it. You just hang it out in the breeze and that gets rid of any odors. I once knitted a sweater and wore only that sweater for an entire month as an experiment. And I aired it on the line dry a couple of times and it was fine. And I was fine and people would still come and sit next to me. So when you think about the astronauts, you know, they obviously don't have a big washing machine up on the space station.
Yeah.
So wool is great.
Mm-hmm. It's magic. Wool is magic.
Yeah, it is. It is. But they've never been able to produce a synthetic fiber with all the properties of wool.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the anti-flammability thing, which is another reason for the astronauts, because you can't have any sparks or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I was amazed. There was a science museum in London a few years ago. They had an exhibition of the early Russian spacecraft. And looked inside one. It was lined with wool. It was just, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I said to one of the curators, I said, am I right? This looks like wool. And he says, oh, well, it's fabric. I said, well, what sort of fabric?
Yeah.
And I just looked at it and it made absolute sense. It would have been wool because of the risk of a spark causing a fire. And synthetics would have immediately caught fire and of course the wool wouldn't.
Wow. That's amazing. Well,
it was phenomenal.
Okay. Well, we're just learning so much right now.
So one day I think there will be wool on the moon and Mars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And we'll have little sheep running around down here producing it.
Yes. I also like had a vision of like a little lamb with like a helmet on, just like floating through space. Like
someone should do a cartoon about a lamb going into space. I think it would be brilliant.
Yes. Okay. So everyone watching and or listening, you have an assignment. Someone out there, please. Yes. Lambs in space. We need that. Okay, so how long did it take to write the book? What was your writing and research process?
Oh, right. As a beginner, and I never thought to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
So I started researching a few years ago just to find out more about the breed and the history. And that was, I have visitors come to the farm and I give talks. They meet the sheep and I give them talks. So I did it for that. So I didn't write down references for the information I was learning. I didn't need it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, my lovely editor got in touch with me. She'd heard me speaking and said, have you ever thought of writing a book? And I said, no, but let's give it a go. So the actual writing process was about a year. Some of the research had done before, but then I had to track back and find the references. Because that they had to be included in the book. And then I did a lot more research as well. So, yes, the writing was about a year. And then the editing. You see, this was all new to me. And it was a learning experience. The editing was about 3 months or so. Then the copy editing. And just when I thought, okay, we've got every reference that we need. And Muna was fantastic to work with. She really was. I couldn't have done it without her. I mean, the book's a team effort. And then Susan, the copy editor, who was so meticulous, my heart would sink. I think we need a reference for this. And I think, where can I find that reference? But we got there. We got there in the end. And I'm so pleased because it gives people the chance, if they really want to follow a part of the story, follow it through. The resources are in the book that start them on their research journey. I've never done a PowerPoint presentation. You know, I usually sit here in the 21st century, my age. I've never done a PowerPoint. And that had to do one at the launch event, which was part of the... we have an International Science Festival in Orkney every September, which is a brilliant event. And now a lot of it's on YouTube. So I would urge people to look up Orkney Science Festival, because you wouldn't believe the fantastic range of subjects that are covered. And yes, they very generously said that we could have the launch event. So I gave a talk there, live streamed around the world, because questions were coming in from not just the audience there, but from people in different countries, which is so exciting. And that's on YouTube.
Great. Okay. Well, I will link it down below for people who are watching and or listening. So I have what might be a very controversial question. Do you have a favorite sheep?
I have a number of favorite sheep. They're usually sheep that I haven't bottle reared, but still decide for some reason that they like me, and they come up to me. And Helen is one of them. She's a smaller ewe. She's quite petite, and she just likes me. And she produces a massive lamb every year. I've no idea how she does it, because she gives birth unseen overnight and sort of is standing there with this massive lamb next to her. And she's a wonderful mother. So Helen will have a home for life on the farm.
Aww.
And then there's Chloe, who's been retired from lambing now. She's quite elderly, but she's just sweet. And she lives with them when we wean the lambs, when the mothers go to the ram, which is called tupping. Obviously, we have to take out their daughters, because some of them might just come into season early and might be gotten pregnant, and we don't want that until they're 2 years old. So, yes, that they get taken away from the mums at that point. And I don't like to just put them in a field on their own. So I have what I call nannies, which are retired ewes that look after them. And Chloe is so sweet with the lambs. Aww. She's just lovely. So, yeah. So Helen and Chloe, and they're my special favorites.
Oh, cute. Barcelona Knits Fiber Festival. We were asked to come do interviews with some of the vendors. And I was speaking with a woman named Anna who owns alpacas. And she admitted that she had had a favorite and that we couldn't show the podcast to her other alpacas because there could be a riot, but she had a favorite. So I figured I should ask you the same question as well.
I mean, I think anyone who has livestock, you do.
Mm-hmm. You do. There's a bond there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So speaking of babies, I would love for you to read the part of the book where the first lamb was born.
So this is page 68 in the book, for anyone who's got the book. May arrived and Paul disappeared south for a few days for a work-related meeting he had to attend. I was on my own. Beryl's possible due date came and went. On 13 May, during the morning, I noticed that Hillary looked preoccupied. She wasn't grazing. There was a lot of pacing around the small lambing field, then standing still, gazing into the distance. I was sure things were stirring. Unfortunately, so was the weather. As the darkness of evening came, so did strong wind and lashing rain, forecast to last all night. I couldn't catch Hillary on my own, nor would she be comfortable if I kept going out to try and check her with a torch. The lambing booklet was consulted for the umpteenth time. If Hillary had the lamb during the night, it would be fine if it suckled well within the first 6 hours. So I worked out if I allowed myself one check on her at about 1 a.m., I'd be able to see any newborn lambs before it was 6 hours old. I set the alarm, but it wasn't really needed. Quite apart from the wakefulness of anxiety, the weather was very noisy, with rain pounding against the bedroom window. I felt so helpless and alone, torn between needing to find out what was happening, but knowing that that would upset the ewes. What could I do on my own anyway, outside in a pitch-black field in a storm? Finally, at last, 1 a.m. came, and I allowed myself to venture out with a strong torch. In the dark, sheep eyes glow in torchlight. I spotted all the sheep but Hillary, well tucked up in the shelter of long rushes. Going around the corner of the field, where there was nothing to mitigate the easterly wind blasting up the hill, I saw the glow of four eyes. one pair belonging to a tiny glam, standing strongly next to Hillary, both with their backs to the wind. I couldn't take a photograph in those conditions, but the image of the new mother and her first lamb standing defiantly in the storm remains clearly with me even now, 7 years later. A difficult decision, though. Should I leave them for 4 or 5 more hours out there in the storm until the delayed daylight of bad weather? Hillary, perhaps because she was inexperienced, had picked one of the least sheltered places to have her first lamb. We did have a couple of little shelters in the field that we thought would give the ewes more choice of sheltered spots for them and their lambs. One not too far away from Hillary and the lamb. With too many options going through my mind, no experience to guide me, and not having the self-confidence to completely trust Bob's advice that the ewes and lambs would be fine and would seek shelter if needed, I quickly decided to pick up the lamb by the front legs and put it in the shelter. I hoped Hillary would follow, so they would both be out of the weather. But even if she didn't, the lamb would be fine out of the driving cold rain, and I could sort things out in the morning. I took just seconds to move the lamb, not touching the body to avoid any of my scent going on it. Then I moved as far away as possible, while still being able to just make out Hillary in the faint light of the torch that I was careful to point away from her. With gut-churning relief, after fearing I'd made the wrong choice and totally messed things up, I saw her walking towards the shelter and her lamb. I left them in peace and went back into the house to dry off and go back to bed. The storm passed quicker than forecast, and by 5 a.m. it was dry and light. I could see Hillary and her lamb from the bedroom window, both looking fine. I got a container with a few beet nuts as a treat for Hillary, and to enable me to get as close as possible to her and her new lamb. She tucked in enthusiastically, and I was rewarded with the sight of the lamb squatting to pee. It was a female. Many photos later, and I left them in peace as the weather improved still further and the sun emerged. The first ever Borroway lamb born in Orkney. I named her Dora.
Oh, I love it. Why Dora? I was very curious about that.
It had to be a D name because the sheep that were born in 2013 that I got as lambs, or in one, two cases, a slightly older sheep, they had B names. So C was 2014 and D was 2015. Dora, I don't know, actually. it just felt the right name for her. Mm-hmm. She was a lovely sheep. We no longer with us, sadly, but she is the mother of two of the breeding rams in Orkney, several breeding females, including one I have in my flock called Ingrid, who is another one who likes me too much. She keeps, when I go out with a bucket of treats, she's the one who comes up to me and tries to jump up and get her head in the bucket. But yes, she reminds me so much of Dora, and she looks so much like her. So aww. Yes, I think Ingrid is a keeper.
Yeah, yeah. So with Making's Journey, we know a lot about pivoting based on circumstances that are out of our control. And also, you know, taking our learnings and sharing knowledge to help others succeed. You in your life have pivoted a lot. Reading through the book, the realization of having a ram in the flock when it was not expected and how that kind of brought you to a certain realization stood out to me. But do you have any lessons or stories or a piece of advice that might help our makers out there that might be going through changes or pivots?
Don't do it alone. I mean, I was lucky. I have a wonderful husband. We've been married for coming up to 43 years, which is kind of scary. So yes, he was there with me, my family, very good neighbours. But what we have now in Orkney, we have had, as you'll know from the book, some real challenges to face. We have the Orkney Borough community, and we do it together. And so yes, my advice to anyone is don't go it alone. Find like-minded people and do it as a team. Support each other. Mm-hmm. And then you've got a whole diversity of skills and experiences. It's not just you. And I think diversity is a wonderful thing. We're all very different with, you know, those of us are farmers in our community. And we bring it all together. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. One person can't know everything, and we're not meant to. No. So,
but yeah. We're meant to work. We're social creatures. Mm-hmm. We're meant to work together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what crafty maker wise are you working on right now? Are you knitting anything, or do you even have time to do such things anymore?
I'm getting more time this year.
Good.
So in fact, I've put off decisions about a possible book two for a year, because mm-hmm. I want this year to do more crafting. So yes, at the moment I'm knitting a lace weight cowl for myself. With our winds, we need lots of layers. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's what I'm knitting at the moment. And there's the sweater for Paul that's kind of three-quarter finished. Mm-hmm. And it's in the cupboard, and I really should get it out and finished. I think the longest I ever had an unfinished object was, it's about 19 years.
I mean, that sounds right.
Yeah. I've got several things on the go. Yeah, there's a lace scarf I'm knitting for. And I'm knitting that with the St. Kilda lace weight yarn that Blacker Yarns spins from Borrowé and Soé fiber. And that's a present for a friend. And I feel really bad that I haven't finished it. I should finish that.
I think that, you know, people in our lives that receive the gifts that we hand make, I think that there is a level of it's okay if it's late.
I just give my homemade gifts to people I know will appreciate them, and will ask me how to wash wool if they don't know.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one. I learned that lesson, definitely. And I learned the lesson of only giving to people who will appreciate, because we do put so much into, it's not just time, it's so much love into everything that we do. Yes. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there any other yarn brands or spinners that you want to kind of give a shout out to that we can share about in this episode?
We do have Orkney Borrowé yarn. Mm-hmm. I've got some. I must wind off the cones. I should explain the Orkney Borrowé yarn, because it's this double coated fleece, and you can just spin it all as one. This is it. This is some that was spun all as one. It's an aran weight. You notice it's not on my skin. So it's wonderful and it's fantastic for cabling, but it's not next to skin soft. But the North Ronaldsay Mill, because they're dealing with a double coated fleece, they have a very special bit of kit that actually does mechanically what women have done through thousands of years. And it separates out the worst of the hair and any kemp. So you get a yarn that is lovely. And that is wonderful. Jenny, who's got the flock on Chapinsay, she's got some for sale, and I will have soon when I find time to wind it into 100-gram hanks. For a spinning company, I would shout out is Blacker Yarns. They were, I think, the first in the UK to be spinning yarn from specific breeds of sheep. The company was started by my friend, the wonderful late Sue Blacker, who was so knowledgeable, such a passion for wool. And you can still buy from them the wool from specified breeds of sheep.
How can fiber artists best support sheep farmers?
Oh, buy their fleece, buy their yarn. Sadly, at the moment, although wool has so many fantastic properties, it is expensive to process, to have mills process it. Scouring can use a lot of electricity if it's not renewable, and that's expensive. We've got the situation in the UK where a lot of our hill breeds that have very coarse fibre, but it is fantastic for carpets. It makes the most resilient carpets that sort of bounce back. You know, you walk on them and anti-flammability. But because of COVID, the market for carpets, which is mostly hotels and cruise ships, they really must have anti-flammable carpeting. Mm-hmm. That kind of dropped off. There are concerns about the price some farmers are getting for their fleece. So yes, just buy the wool. I know there are so many small mills in America now that are doing such a grand job of spinning their local fleeces. In the UK, if you want to find British wool, there's a website called woolsack.org, which I run.
There you go.
Yeah, that comes from the 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games, which were held in London. And Sue Blacker's idea was we had to get British wool to the Olympics. Yeah. So she did reams of paperwork to make Woolsack, as it was called, an official part of the Inspire program linked to the Olympic Games. We had volunteers throughout the UK making British wool cushions, which were stuffed with British wool, and we gave them as gifts to the athletes.
Amazing.
There's a whole long story attached to that. But as part of that, because back then in 2010, 2011, it was not easy to find British wool knitting yarn or crochet yarn or weaving yarn. So we had a website that Paul set up, my husband set up, and I put on it links to all the places you could buy British wool. And I kept hearing feedback from the people whose company I'd linked that they got a lot of traffic through the website. So when the Olympics were over, I kept the website going and expanded it. It's got no advertising. I just do it as a volunteer. It's a very, very simple, easy website. And it is literally just a reference library of links to where you can buy British wool products. The thing that's changed in the last, 13 years is we now have a section I called single farm yarns. So these are yarns being produced by a single farm. And back in 2010, there were two farms doing it. And the only contact with them was by post or telephone. And now we've got a whole section of single farm yarns with website links. And for those who are vegetarian and vegan, but who do want to use wool, we also have a wool-only flock section where they're flocks that are not involved in the meat industry at all. Because, of course, in the UK, most sheep, it's part of our meat industry. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So for those who want to use wool but are very torn about, you know, their personal ethics and whatever, I do have a small section on the website where I list any flocks I find that are wool-only flocks.
That's wonderful. That's part of it that I didn't even think of. As a vegetarian, I didn't think about that part.
It's everyone's personal,
of course,
personal philosophy. Yeah. But I wanted to give people a choice and make it possible for people to use wool if they wanted.
Yeah.
The one thing I do have to say, I have to be honest, I have been very busy the past 2 years. I used to sort of update the website every month. So that would be checking existing URLs, making sure they were all working, and then adding new ones. Mm-hmm. I found it badly needs updating.
That's okay. That's okay. We understand.
But I think a lot of it's still very usable, and it is definitely on my to-do list, ideally before lambing starts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I bet that's when you get really busy.
My lovely daughter comes up, bless her. She doesn't get a lot of holiday, but she does come up for a week, and she's an invaluable help. I mean, the ewes get on with it almost all the time. They just do it themselves out in the field and are fantastic mothers. But you've got to be observing and just spotting the very rare occasion. Either she needs a little bit of help with the lambing, or that for some reason a lamb needs a bit of assistance after it's been born.
Mm-hmm. Or you are running out to the fields to protect them from the birds of prey.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That it was about the third year of lambing. And I had three ewes having twins almost at the same time. And there were these ravens hanging around in pairs. And they were such intelligent birds.
Mm-hmm.
But they were trying to separate you know, one twin from a mother, and some of the ewes who hadn't lambed yet were attacking the birds, which was brilliant. But yeah, I just thought, this can't go on. So I grabbed a broom and sort of waved it, and I rushed out in the field, not really thinking, this is going to freak out the sheep. And actually, it didn't. It's almost as if they knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
And the ravens all flew away, and then it came back up, and I just kept doing that. And then the next year, there really weren't very many of them. And now they're intelligent birds, and hooded crows as well, they're the same. Mm-hmm. And we're not bothered nearly as much as many of our neighbors. Mm-hmm. I like to be up at first light before the birds are up. So it's not really dawn. You can just see without a torch.
Mm-hmm.
I just wander around the lambing field and just make sure there's no one weak that might be preyed upon when the birds wake up and start looking for their breakfast.
We have, here in Seattle, in our neighborhood, we have crows that know who we are because we give them treats so that they won't dive bomb us as much. Basically, that was my, all right, you've dive bombed me enough. I'm just going to try and be your friend and make you like me by giving you food. But they'll follow us when we're on dog walks. They'll follow us around the neighborhood. So that's my version of knowing that birds are smart. But I feel like I would have been out there as well with a broom. I would have looked probably insane because I'm running around in a field yelling at birds.
Yep, that was pretty much it. Yep. Was intending to do with the broom, I don't know, but it was there. So I grabbed
self-defense.
Yeah. Well, make myself bigger, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
More threatening.
Yeah.
But yeah, it worked. It worked.
Yeah.
But yeah, you always get new ones that have been, hatched, and they come along, ravens, oh yeah, we know it all, oh yeah. So I've got to teach them, this is not the place to be.
Yeah, don't mess with Jane.
Yeah.
Okay, so in chapter 5, you talk about the lambs being in the house because it makes it easier to feed. And you said that you talk to them as you do talk to all of your sheep. I have dogs. And when I talk to my dogs, I have a special voice for them. And I end up giving them a ton of nicknames, as most pet owners do, especially with dogs and cats. Now, the very important question that I have for you is, do you have a special voice when you talk to your sheep? And have you given them all a million nicknames?
They're all registered, or at least birth notified. So they all have official names.
I love it.
Which actually my kids try and get in on this, on the naming. And this is why we ended up with a ram called Bollocks.
Yes.
Yes. Who lived up to his name in terms of his progeny. I've got one of his sons in my flock. I have the veto. I have the final veto over names. There are some suggestions that, no. We're not. L was the letter last year. And they came up with some pretty shocking ideas. I had two bottle-fed lambs last year, and they were both one of twins, and for various reasons the mums couldn't rear twins. They were Lara and Louis. So I do. It's a slightly higher pitched voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I'm out with the flock, it's I call them and it's a sort of come on, and that's and if I want them to follow me around, I clap my hands, so I say come on and clap my hands, and that they know that means they're going to some fresh grazing. And the whole flock, I mean, over the years, we've got to know each other. Mm-hmm. And the days of really wild sheep that I really couldn't do much with are long gone. And they follow me around. Lara and Louis still love me dearly. Oh, I'm their mummy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's a sad side to it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And certainly at times, it's physically very demanding.
Mm-hmm.
But to see a young mother with her first lamb, or an experienced one with her twins, it's just wonderful.
Mm.
And they stay much closer to their mothers than modern sheep breeds. I mean, this is the primitive thing and being wary of prey animals. Mm-hmm. But from about 2 weeks of age, they very briefly in the evening kind of form a lamb gang and race around madly. It's very short, and I know when to go out to see it.
What do you know anything about lamb gangs? Like why it happens? Is it just like to get out the last little bit of energy before?
I don't know. I doubt, because with modern sheep breeds, it's really quite a thing. And it often does happen in the early evening. I mean, sheep have routines. They'll graze for a bit and then they lie down and ruminate. And then they'll graze a bit more and lie down and ruminate. And especially if you're in a part of the world that doesn't have a huge difference between hours of daylight in winter and hours of daylight in summer, because we go from about 5 hours that might be perpetual gloom because it's horribly cloudy or misty to like, well, it's light enough to see at midnight for the summer solstice. So that does alter the pattern of the sheep. But yeah, if you want to see lamb gangs, just go around about tea time to a farm near you where they've got lambs and hopefully you'll see them racing around. Young animals play.
Yeah.
They do. And even some of my one-year-olds, if, you know, if they're rushing down the hill, some of them start leaping in the air. There's no reason for that other than the joy of leaping in the air. It's like watching children play.
May we all live life with the joy of a lamb just leaping in the air for no other reason than to just do it. What is next for you?
I really want to get back to my crafting. It has suffered over the past 2 years. To consolidate our community, we all are getting to know each other. We live on 5 different islands, and transport between the islands is very challenging, especially in the winter. It's expensive. It creates extra difficulties, but we've had our first in-person meeting, which was attended by half the people because the storms, the weather that day cancelled some of the ferries. So we're going to meet in July when there shouldn't be any ferry. We should all have finished with lambing. Those who are making hay and things, that should be over.
I hope that everybody goes and checks out the book. What are the best ways to find the book, to find the audiobook?
I think any book that's, I'm still to get my first royalties check. I think it happens later this year.
Oh, wow.
So that's going to be quite, that's going to be a new experience.
Yeah.
If you've got a lovely local bookshop, then do go to your local bookshop. So that is the best way. But yes, otherwise you can buy it anywhere where you buy books. Go to the Chelsea Green website. They're lovely people. It's a fantastic company. They probably get a bit more profit if you buy direct from them.
Yeah.
So go to the Chelsea Green website and the audiobook anywhere where you usually get your audiobooks so that you can carry on crafting ones. We have a website about sheep, which is orkneyborrowray.com. And we're on social media, and that is Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram so far. There's this threads thing I haven't quite got my head around. I sort of run the social media, and I keep making sure there's plenty of photos of sheep. And there will definitely be lots of photos of lambs from all the flocks. And that will be starting in April.
Awesome.
So those of you who want your lamb fix.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me. This has been
fun. I've really enjoyed it. It's been great.
Good. Yeah. All right. Well, everybody go pick up the book and learn more about sheep. Knowing the history of the things that we love is really important. And there's a lot of learning in this book. So, and also just enjoyment talking about lambs. Yeah. Thanks again.